Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Socialism 2009. This is the second session of the day. My name is Adrian. I'm going to be chairing and moderating the discussion today. And this is Iran from the 1979 revolution to rebellion today. So you're in the right room, everybody. And we're fortunate to have three speakers today. I'm going to go ahead and introduce those three speakers in the order that they're going to speak. And they're each going to talk for about 15 minutes. And after that, we'll have plenty of time for Q&A, for discussion from the floor, and for people to ask questions directly of the speakers if there's other things that you want to know. So our first speaker is going to be Barry Shepherd. Barry Shepherd was the leader of the SWP, the Socialist Workers' Party, here in the United States for many years. He was in Iran during the insurrection, so he's going to be able to talk today about his personal experience at that time. And we have his book available here today, which people should check out. It's available, it's distributed by Haymarket, it's available in this room. It's the first volume of his history of Socialist Workers' Party, and the second volume will be available soon, and will include Iran. So give a welcome to Barry Shepherd. Our second speaker will be Shahram, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pronounce it.
Agamir,
thank you. He was born and raised in Iran. He's an activist and a co-producer of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. It's a weekly program that's broadcast on KPFA. And he's also written and translated articles in Farsi on Iranian history and politics. So give him a welcome, please. And our last speaker will be Lisa Starr. Lisa Starr is a labor writer for Socialist Worker and SocialistWorker.org. And if you haven't checked out the coverage on SocialistWorker.org about what has been going on in Iran, you should make sure you get a flyer for that website and do that today. He's also a contributor to the International Socialist Review. Please give a welcome for Lisa Starr. And now I'm going to turn it over to Barry Shepherd.
This was a very exciting year, 1979, in Iran. A tremendous revolution. To begin with, though, this revolution was against both a monarchy and a vicious, brutal monarchy that was installed by the United States in 1953. The United States trained its secret police. A little help from Israel, too. The secret police was called the Sabak. I guess that's an acronym. It was a terribly brutal regime with torture, suppression of basic rights. The Iran in 1979, following the installation of the Shah in 1953, Iran was an outpost of Washington, close ally aimed at the rest of the Middle East, along with Israel. The big upsurge began in 1978, with massive demonstrations, waves of them, against the Shah. They got bigger and bigger. I can't go over all the details, of course. By September, there were demonstrations of 3 to 4 million people. Right after that, the Shah declared martial law. But this didn't stop the demonstrations. They continued. Then on October 3, the national bank workers went on strike, both economic and political. And this snowballed. More and more sectors of the working class joined this strike until it encompassed the industrial workers also. and especially the oil workers, because the oil was key to the Iranian economy. So this strike, general strike, was one of the longest in world history. I'm not sure exactly. Certainly in Iranian history. And that was then December 10th, 11th, there were demonstrations of 7 million people. So this, and the working class strike drew in the peasantry too, and also the oppressed nationalities. The oppressed nationalities in Iran make up about one half of the population, roughly, I'm not sure. There's a whole bunch of them in all different languages and areas of the country. And in fact, in some of the oppressed nationalities were in the forefront of this struggle. So this is what brought the Shah down. A massive working class uprising that drew in all sectors of the population. Youth, women. But there was one thing lacking. There was no mass working class revolutionary party to lead this struggle. The Communist Party, which called itself the Tudor Party, had been fairly large before the coup in 53. But it discredited itself by not fighting against the installation of the Shah. We can go into why that is, orders from Moscow. And in the intervening years, most of its leaders left the country to the Soviet Union. And there were some other groups, guerrilla groups, but this did not amount to be able to provide a leadership to this massive working class uprising. And into that vacuum, that leadership vacuum, stepped the clergy under the leadership of Khomeini. Khomeini was in exile in Paris. He had opposed the Shah and was sent into exile because of participation in a fight against the Shah in 1963. More than anyone else in the clergy, Khomeini was hard against the Shah. And that's what made the masses involved in this struggle look to him through him, the clergy. He stayed hard against the Shah. A bourgeois nationalist force, the National Front, which had been the government at the time of the coup, also became discredited. And at the time of this uprising, they were trying to make an accommodation with the Shah. Their program was, there are three pillars of Iran: the army, the Shah, and the United States. All of those got smashed that was wiped out during the course of the uprising. The insurrection that rested upon these mass demonstrations and general strike, that's what provided the power behind it, was not called by anybody. Not by Khomeini, not by anybody. It began amongst aircraft mechanics. They're called Homofars, who had begun to organize their own demonstrations against the Shah. And in one base, the Royal Guard attacked during this period. I'm losing some of the chronology here, but it's impossible for me to go over it all. The Shah fled in January, early January. And a lot of his family had fled before because they could see the handwriting on the wall. But the regime still stayed there. And it continued a bloody crackdown against these demonstrations. The demonstrations were faced with army, secret police, the Royal Guard. And there were many, it's bloody. But they kept going. These Homofars at this one base were faced with an attack by the Royal Guard. They fought back. They armed themselves from the armory on the base. They distributed arms to citizens around the base, and together with citizens, they began to fight against the Royal Guard, these elite troops. And they pushed them back block by block. This was the beginning of the insurrection. Although they didn't know it. Nobody knew it. I was there to help some socialists get organized, and I remember we were driving around Tehran and these cars coming by that were ambulances, clearly, with white flags on them, some of them bloody. They were taking the wounded from this battle to hospitals. So already the army was losing control of the streets. And then the army had a curfew of 10 o'clock at night, where they would shoot if you were out. They moved the curfew up to 4 in the afternoon. I was eating with Iranian friends when the waiter came over and said, "Hey, you better get back to where you are staying because the curfew has been moved up to 4 o'clock and they're going to shoot." So we shot back to where we were staying. At 4, we went up on the roof to see what was going to happen. A helicopter came over, with a machine gun shooting at us. We ducked back down in the stairwell. Then, but in the southern part of Tehran, there was a defiance of the curfew. Masses came out into the streets, set fires, and the army then capitulated. And basically collapsed, at least in Tehran. Now, I'm just going to go as fast as I can over to them. I was there to work with Iranian socialists who had formed themselves here in the United States. And when the Shah fled, they went back. The main leader of that group, who's here, Babak Zare, held a press conference in January before the insurrection, announcing the formation of the Iranian Socialist Workers' Party. By the way, later he spent 6 years in Khomeini's jails after the big crackdown against the left in 1982-1983. They started putting out a newspaper called The Worker, Kagar. They were able to put out in total 129 issues before the big crackdown happened. And they supported the revolution, but they also put forward an independent working class program for democratic rights and going in the direction of socialism. Shortly after the insurrection, the women in the Socialist Workers' Party, and one of them is here, Kata, they organized around International Women's Day to demand rights for women. This became a big battle with big demonstrations, many attacks on the women, including knifing. So in that sense, it was very successful. But I'm going to have to end here. Well, okay. There was a lot. I'm going to say one thing about the regime that emerged after the insurrection. It was composed of two wings. Two wings of the capitalist class that we've seen again in these last few weeks. Different personalities. But Khomeini tried to put these two wings together. One wing, pro-Western, wanting a Western-style parliamentary democracy, and the other wing, the clergy. The clergy wing was the most powerful because they had sided with the people in the uprising. That's what gave them their prestige and the mass base to rule. But these two wings were at each other's throats right from the beginning. Deep factional struggles. There was even an assassination in the cabinet. At the end of the year, the clergy wing completely smashed the other wing. There's more to it, I'll leave it at that. I hope that we might be able to set up some kind of an informal meeting if anyone wants to learn more about what happened in this first year. Thank you.
Everybody can hear me? Yes. Good afternoon, or is it good morning yet? Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Internet. I want to thank International Socialist Organization for giving me this opportunity to talk here. I want to say at the beginning that at this point in my life, I'm actually undergoing difficult times because my dad was, had a hit and run accident. He was hit by a car, so has been in ICU for the last few days. So I want to say I'm not as coherent as I should be. I do want to say that I hope you will understand. I like to take this opportunity to sort of talk about a couple of things. I think it's important that this panel sort of establishes this nexus between Iranian 1979 revolution and what's going on today in Iran. Without understanding this background, one would not be able to grasp the significance of what we have been witnessing in the last few weeks in Iran, starting in 2 weeks prior to the actual June 12th election date. I want to actually say something about the start off by saying, I need to probably pull this up a little bit. I think that's as far as it gets,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
all right, not a problem. Yeah. Okay, can everybody hear
I'll
me? Or
this one too.
Oh, so they get a stereo effect. Sorry about that.
It's going to sound great on the tape.
Just have to do a little bit.
Sorry.
You can just pull this out.
Yeah.
Pull this you can out. Hold it.
It's not...
I think
it would
that.
Not sound...
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Is everyone here?
Thank you.
In the back?
It would, you just have to do a little bit of editing as we do in the radio. So that's not take all those disruptive sounds or noises out. So anyhow, what I'd like to say is a couple of things about the nature of the 1979 revolution, because I think in some ways we are getting a rerun of a scenario of the 1979 revolution in Iran in some ways. The Iranian revolution of 1979 has been characterized as an Islamic revolution by some analysts and scholars. The notion by itself, if you identify the revolution by the sort of a norm that was established in the wake of the revolution, perhaps the word Islamic perhaps could be correct. But if you look at the actual makeup of the revolutionary forces and what the demands were, then it begs the question of how Islamic was the revolution, really. So when you look at the makeup of the social classes involved, I think Barry correctly mentioned this was a mass movement. It involved many different classes in the street protest, and eventually led to the working class were the latecomers in this revolution, believe it or not. And as much as you have to understand that Iranian history, in modern history, the major mass movements in Iranian history have been urban protests. It has been over 150 years that we have ever seen any sort of a peasant movement of any significance in Iran. So the nature of upheaval, social upheavals and revolutionary struggles in Iran have been centered around major urban areas, particularly Tehran, the capital city, the second largest city of Iran, Tabriz. It's not the second largest city in terms of population anymore, but it has been up to about 10 years ago. So that's important to understand that this was a... But Khomeini came into power because of his past history, because of his defiance of the Pahlavi regime, the monarchy, but also because he was resorting to a populist rhetoric. This was a third... In many people's assessment, this could be characterized as any sort of another third world populist movement, anti-imperialist movement, more so than what you call an Islamic revolution. And that was the key to Khomeini's success in terms of his language. So these forces, basically, what it had common with other third world populist movements was these movements generally have vague aspirations and no precise programs. The rhetoric was more important than the actual programs and the blueprints. And they usually claim to return to native roots, so-called native roots, and a means for eradicating cosmopolitan ideas, so-called, and chanting a non-capitalist, non-communist, quote-unquote, third way towards development. So the attack, the target is some foreign power, basically. And the capital that is related to foreign... I mean, basically, the capitalist class that is related to foreign capital. In actual fact, many of these slogans and key concepts are basically borrowed from the outside world, ironically, especially from Europe. For instance, Khomeini used organizations and the type of politics to mobilize the masses, but at the same time, it distrusted any form of political pluralism, liberalism, and grassroots democracy. And you can see that today, the reason I go to this, because you can see that also in the language that is coming out of Ahmadinejad's government. Ahmadinejad, for instance, has this populist rhetoric, but when you look at, and I'm going to go over that, when you look at his policies, you don't see much of his substance in terms of delivering to the urban poor or the working classes in the society. So this kind of language, however, did appeal to many people in Iran. And as Barry mentioned, later on, there was a consolidation of power and the clerics basically established their own monopoly of power for the years to come. And this was true during the Iran-Iraq war in 1980s, when they actually unleashed a wave of terror unprecedented in Iranian history, and I think Barry mentioned that some of it. The target of this terror were the leftists, the nationalists, liberals, the secular forces, basically. They were not spared from the violence and the coercion that the regime actually exercised at the time. Thousands of political prisoners were executed during this time. Torture was commonplace in Iranian prisons, as the people in this audience who can probably testify to that. And the reason I'm talking about these things, because do not be surprised when you see all these televised confessions, forced confessions that appear on television, and people coming out and saying that, oh, we were the agents of the foreign powers, this was part of a Velvet Revolution, another one of those Velvet Revolution inspired and organized by the United States, in this case specifically referring to the European powers. You see that these days too. So one should not be fooled by this, and we should go back to that history. Alas, at that point in the 1980s, some of the people within the anti-imperialist discourse fell for this populist rhetoric, and they supported the Islamic Republic and its sort of policies vis-a-vis the opposition. Because the argument was, this is a newly born revolution, and it's being threatened by the foreign powers, foreign, basically, imperialist powers outside the country. Therefore, we need, in order to defend the revolution, we need to sort of close our eyes and sort of neglect or not pay attention to the internal repression against the opposition. I think it's a very short-sighted view of looking at things, because imagine if Iran, as a major force in the region, regional player in the whole in that part of the world, if it can establish democratic polity, if it can create democratic institutions, if it can create the space for public participation in terms of people being able to do self-determination, and this self-determination concept has been all along, for the last 150 years, part of the Iranian polity. The idea of self-determination next to idea of national sovereignty vis-a-vis imperialist powers outside Iran, these two were running hand in hand throughout the 1906-1911 constitutional revolution of Iran, through the movement for nationalization of oil in 1950s, as Barry mentioned, that movement was brought to an end by CIA, MI6, the British-US sponsored coup. It was also present in 1978-79 revolutionary upheaval. Those aspirations, those two elements, have not been completely fulfilled. And that's why you see people out in the street today. And when they talk about the notion of freedom, you have to understand the notion of freedom in Iranian politics goes beyond freedom, political, just individual freedoms. It has to do with establishing a democratic polity, with the ability of people to participate in order to have self-determination. So azadi in Farsi, it could be literally translated to freedom, but it really has to do with the notion of self-determination. And it's important to grasp that. It's because, I give you an example, I mean, self-determination is not just about having three political parties. It has to do, and we did see that during the 1978-79 revolution, when these grassroots movements, grassroots entities, institutions were created, the workers' councils, the councils within the universities, these neighborhood associations, neighborhood councils. So they were all part of these civic associations that were generated by this upheaval in Iran. So they go beyond a liberal democracy in some ways. But today in Iran, what you see, and I think before I talk about that, I want to say something about what happened after 1988. After the war with Iraq ended in 1988, what you witnessed was a period of revolutionary thermidor, if you will, like the French thermidor, if you will, and this was a period of what they call reconstruction.
So what it meant was bringing in programs of structural adjustment, new liberal policies to this sphere of economy. There was no opening up of the polity of the country. The repression was still there. There were some openings, especially in the 90s during the Khatami's two-term as a president. There was some openings in terms of a press to some extent, and in culture sphere and art there were some openings, and there were some room for people, breathing space to organize, and in 1997 through 2005 before Ahmadinejad came to power. And I want to talk about Ahmadinejad and his power base because it's important. He has this unbridled populism, rhetoric that comes out of it. In terms of the economy of the country, he has not delivered what he said he would deliver in 2005. He came to power in 2005 because he was running against Hashemi Rafsanjani, the two-term president, in late 1980s, early 1990s, mid-90s. He personified what was wrong with the Islamic Republic as a state. He personified corruption, he personified usurping the power, he personified what was wrong with the state in general. And he was a cleric. That was another thing. Ahmadinejad ran against him, that's why he got elected with a little bit of an adjustment in the polls. He got a little bit of help from in the first round, against the other opponent. But he got to that position, he was put in that position by a group of people that are affiliated with the Revolutionary Guards, a strong military force, and the Basijis, you have been hearing about them, and the intelligence circles, the security apparatus of the regime. So he represents that circle. And what he has been doing is he's trying, the Revolutionary Guards are trying to consolidate their power vis-a-vis the society. They already control a good portion of the economy, and I'll get to that in terms of how this works within the Iranians. I don't have time to go through the details. I'll be happy to talk about it in these details in the discussion period. What they're trying to do is they're already controlling a good portion of the economy. And whoever in Iran controls the state has, in an unmediated way to control the economy too, because 65% of the Iranian economy is controlled by the state. And not only that, through the state, control of the state and the government in particular, you can have access to credit, you can have access to export-import credits, licenses. So these become sources of accumulation of wealth under the Islamic Republic. So controlling the state and the government in particular is very important. So that's why it's a high-stake game for these factions within the regime. And Revolutionary Guards already have a strong, obviously, coercive force. They control a big part of the economy. And now they want to monopolize, they consolidate the power within the political circle, within the political establishment. So that's what is going on. And I think there is an opposition to it. Obviously, you have seen it. It's not about... The opposition may personify in the person of Musavi. But we have to understand these grievances, as I said, go back. You have to go back in Iranian history to see what is at stake. People want to have participation in the polity. And for a lot of these people, it's not that they have any illusions that Musavi will necessarily implement very profound reforms, because they have already witnessed how that project reform failed under Khatami, and it was aborted in the 8 years of his rule. The idea is that because there's a power shift, if there is a power shift, there will be opening up of the public space for other groups, the grassroots groups, to organize, such as women's associations, student groups, the workers. There are no independent labor unions in Iran. They have come under severe attack by Ahmadinejad's government. The union, the teachers, the transport workers, other groups that have called for independent labor organizations, or even, adjustment in their wages, or even getting paid. And we have to, let's not forget what is happening under Ahmadinejad. And Ahmadinejad and Rafsanjani have a common team in this. The privatization that takes place under Ahmadinejad has to do with the crony capitalism. Basically, what you witnessed during the period of Yeltsin, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, In other words, there's a limited group of circle of people who has access to the credit and who has the ability to control these privatized or public assets that are privatized. They become the property or they're actually owners of those assets. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry. I'll try to get more.
Well, the previous speakers have made my job easier in some ways and a lot harder in others, which is coming up with something else to say. I think it's really important that we had, to start with, Barry's account of the revolution of 78-79, because what we saw in Iran was one of the great proletarian uprisings in human history of the 20th century. It was profound. It embraced virtually the entire working class. It went on for weeks, and it was the thrust behind the insurrection that Barry described, which may have been improvised, but was propelled forward by mass working class action, and it really the clergy could only take power after the working class had blown the Shah's regime out of the way. And really, what we have to understand is what's called the Islamist Revolution is really a counter-revolution. It was a hijacking of a workers' revolution and a coming to power of a petty bourgeois elements and sections of capital, which used their control of the state to wind down that struggle, first by dividing the left and then by slaughtering it over a period of time. And they had some help in consolidating their power, actually by the United States, in a perverse kind of way, because people might remember the famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, helping organize the Iraqi invasion of Iran, which the U.S. at the time thought would be easy pickings on the basis of the revolution. Of course, that created a tremendous nationalist backlash in Iran and allowed Khomeini and the people around him to consolidate power. And over what was really a horrible war, a sort of World War I type devastation, which left a million people dead with years of trench warfare, use of chemical weapons, many of them supplied by the United States to Iraq. And it was in that period, though, that the various factions inside the Iranian capitalist class were compelled to close ranks. And in the initial period, what's called, it's not the best term in the world, but it'll do for now, is the Islamist left, people who understood that in order to mobilize the working class and actually tap into that great working class movement, they actually had to emphasize the social side of Islam and those sorts of messages. And one of them was Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was prime minister for, I believe, the entirety of the Iran-Iraq war. And Mousavi described his motivation in this kind of way. He said, the way of Islam is to attend to social justice. And he said, capital must not rule, and the priority of this regime should be the poor and not the well-off. And so he and the camp around him represented a school of thought which said, we have to use the state to actually build up a national economy independently from imperialism. And in the short run, we have to build a kind of economy that would be able to withstand the pressures of war. And Mousavi was able to organize a rationing system that kept people fed and so forth. Of course, he was also the prime minister presiding over human wave attacks, which sent tens of thousands of Iraqi boys and young men to their death. He's not a touchy-feely reformist figure in that sense. And of course, he was also in office during the period of crackdown that Barry described. So that was one camp. At the same time, there was what was called an Islamist right, and this was based on the middle class merchants, the bazaaris, and the clergy, which had a vast reach through the mosques across society, both in urban and rural areas. And as Barry said, they gained a lot of credibility for their forthright opposition to the dictatorship. And had a kind of a network that was able to create a provisional government and ultimately consolidate power. A third camp emerged a little bit later on, which has been called the modern right or the pragmatic right. I would think of it as sort of the big capital right, headed by Rafsanjani, who was kind of the mediator between big capital and the middle class merchants in the revolutionary period. And these factions held together under the threat of war and under the need to consolidate their control and bury the legacy of the workers' revolution. But after the Iran-Iraq war ended in 88 and Khomeini died a year later, these debates began to come out into the open. And initially, this pragmatic right, this modern right around Rafsanjani came in, tried to use the state control of the economy that had taken over directly by the state and through religious foundations, which were virtually controlled by the state, and try to modernize and restructure the Iranian economy and help it recover from the devastation of the war. But this was a very incomplete and unsuccessful process. The rates of growth and investment remained sluggish, and there was a kind of a weariness around this sort of model. And essentially, Rafsanjani in his two terms in office ran out of steam in terms of political credibility, in terms of charges of corruption. He was one of the wealthiest men in Iran. His family controlled the pistachio export market. And also, more recently, Rafsanjani created a chain of private universities. So he's quite a big, powerful capitalist. He basically retreated, and it was in that period that this wing of the so-called pragmatic right made a bloc with the remnants of the Islamist left. Now, what had changed about this Islamic left politics was that rather than stress the state ownership, I would say state capitalism, as a way of developing the Iranian economy, given the influence of neoliberalism around the world, privatization, deregulation, and so forth, they moved substantially in that direction. So rather like Gorbachev in Russia, they tried to offer people a deal. We'll loosen up a lot of the strictures of Islamist rule. We'll open up the society for greater freedom. We'll pull back on the oppression of women somewhat. And this was part of the appeal, particularly to the more educated middle class elements. And Khatami was elected president in a landslide, a very surprising landslide with two-thirds of the vote back in 97. However, he was unable to deliver for a number of reasons. First of all, I mean, he would never really promise anything to working class. He delivered less. Most of his policies were aimed at shoring up Iranian capital and restructuring it to the detriment of the working class, which saw his living standards continue to deteriorate. But at the same time, he was unable to deliver on any kind of the real freedoms that he had promised. The power ministries, the military, etc., remained under the control of the conservative right and under the supreme leader Ali Khamenei, and they really weren't able to loosen that grip much at all. In fact, when students began to organize, they found themselves brutally repressed on a number of occasions, jailed and so on. The government unable or unwilling to respond. Similarly, when liberal newspapers were shut down, editors arrested, they were unable to respond to that. When the Guardian Council, the system of clerics, which vets all the candidates and has veto power over the electoral system essentially, basically invalidated all the reformers' candidates in the 2004 elections, including 80 sitting members of parliament. And so really, the reformers ran into a brick wall of the hardliners who were determined to consolidate their power, and they were basically saying the hardliners were basically saying that's it. And Rafsanjani, as the candidate, did them a favor in that he allowed Ahmadinejad to pose as a populist while putting across the consolidation of this hardline faction. So really, you know, what we have is, as Sharon pointed out, a kind of a fake populism by Ahmadinejad, who in fact tried to cut subsidies for staple goods for the poor, but was unsuccessful. Who carried out a privatization, as he mentioned, Eastern European style, put out a bunch of shares to the poor, which could then be manipulated by a handful of capitalists to control the economy. All those things really hammer down the working class still further. And so this economic battle was looming behind these recent elections coming up. Because although there had been a wave of privatizations, $6 billion worth under Ahmadinejad, as Sharon mentioned, nearly two-thirds of the economy is still in state hands. So this next wave of privatization, which was blessed by Khamenei himself, it said we want to privatize 80% of what the state owns, whoever controls this privatization process is going to control the Iranian economy. It has a potential to completely reconfigure the Iranian ruling class. And so that's what Mousavi represents, is an attempt, blocking with Rafsanjani, who was an old rival, to try and combat that process. So you have basically two factions of the capitalist class battling out over control. And the hardliners were quite confident, because since the reformers had failed to deliver, they believed that they would basically stay home and they'd be able, and Ahmadinejad would be able to be reelected without any problem whatsoever. But Mousavi, while still being very vague in terms of offering something for the workers, criticized the handling of the economy. He stressed the rights of women. He stressed the rights of national minorities. He stressed the greater individual freedoms and so forth. And it caught fire. It caught fire with a big wave of activism, a big wave of struggle, which I believe stunned Ahmadinejad and Khamenei into basically stealing the election with an by declaring a first round victory. They were afraid that in the Iranian system, the top two vote-getters, if no one gets 50%, go into a second round. They were afraid that Mousavi, if didn't win the first round, would certainly be able to win the second round. And with that would come a tremendous control over the whole direction of Iranian capitalism. But once that stolen election came down, the response was the election rallies that had come out all through Tehran and all around the country became massive uprisings to defend democracy. Whatever people thought about the individual candidates, mass movement developed to try to argue, where's our vote? We want our votes counted. And rather than being cowed initially by the repression, people fought back. When the besieged, the paramilitaries who were organized through the mosques, attacked them with motorcycles and sticks. People figured out tactics on the street to knock them off their motorcycles, set them on fire, beat them, and so on. And they did that day after day. And the argument that this was a CIA orchestrated coup simply defies any logic whatsoever. First of all, any long-time observers of Iranian elections could have shown conclusively that the results don't make sense. They were announced before the vote could have possibly happened. Second of all, the movement itself, as Reese Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who's been to Iraq many times and written a book about it recently, pointed out. He said, look, if the CIA is trying to orchestrate this, they're doing a pretty piss-poor job because the demands here are far beyond anything that they would want to see, and certainly there's certainly no candidate that would accord to U.S. interest in any real kind of way. This is a movement that goes far beyond Mousavi's ability to kind of coordinate it as well. And I think there's another factor in here that's not actually been remarked on, which is bubbling up under this is the whole question of the working class and the economy and the prospects for young people in particular in a country where the vast majority of people are young. Starting in 2004, through over the next couple of years, there was a tremendous workers' movement that began to emerge despite incredible repression. I mean, people being machine-gunned out of helicopters and arrested and tortured. Workers basically organized underground unions. They did so by using a legal cover of having an Islamic charity, for example, given workplace to be able to function as an underground union. They were able, in some cases where they were more organized and confident, able to actually revive the Shura, the Workers' Council, and some big confrontations. And I'll read you a quick quote about a strike at a brick factory to give you some flavor for that, where the bosses cut back on the rate that they were supposed to pay for the bricks. The day before the strike started, all of us, 3,000 workers, gathered in the desert outside the mill. It was like Karbala, the Shia pilgrimage in Iraq. Candidates stood up, and a strike committee was elected by a show of hands. Since we brickmakers carry our homes on our backs, our strikes naturally meant that we occupied the mill. After 1 week, the army arrived and started threatening us representatives and the others. But no one listened. Strikes may be banned, but in situations like this, the law cannot be enforced. 3,000 United workers are strong. The owner goes to the army and complains, and the soldiers come and fire off some threats, but nothing more. After 2 weeks, there was new negotiation with the boss. Now he conceded to our demands. As we went back to work, the Shura was dissolved, but we elected representatives remained active and stood up against the boss when he delayed our payment. So that's an extraordinary achievement, right? That's what's underpinning this. And if you couple that kind of energy, and there's another dramatic struggle I don't have time to talk about, of the Tehran bus drivers who have repeatedly gone on strike to fight against high fares and for better pay and working conditions for themselves. There was a May Day demonstration this year. A couple thousand workers participated. It was illegal. People are still in jail over that. In hindsight now, what those workers were doing is really an advanced preview of what we saw much more widely in society. I'm not saying that one led directly to another, but in a sense they were the first taking on the popular grievances in society, and that's what caught hold of it. And the unemployment for young people is profound. For men, in their early 20s, it's over 20%. For women, it's twice that. And the lack of any real prospects an Iranian economy that has a massive population growing, but is still not able to deliver the goods for the mass of people. That underpins this tremendous uprising that we've seen, and I think that's really what's behind here. Essentially, what we have is a split in the ruling class, which is then opening the way for a mass working class upsurge. It may be that people began with a very simple question of, count our votes, but inevitably it's raising the social question. Inevitably it's going to raise the question of who gets what. Inevitably it's going to raise the question of how society should be organized. And in what form this split in the ruling class is going to take is very difficult to say. The right wing is tentative. They haven't slaughtered people and drowned it in blood as they might have done, because they weren't confident enough to do so, because there's splits within the clergy and the ruling class generally. But the other side is weak organizationally as well. Mousavi said, we're going to keep on fighting. We don't accept this as legitimate. Well, what's going to happen? Are they going to be incorporated into some kind of loyal opposition, or will they be jailed in a kind of a Stalinist purge trial system, exposing the regime as a police state and wrecking its legitimacy? Either way, the legitimacy of the system as it's been constituted since the revolution is in question. And that's and significantly, the contending forces are taking up the legacy of the revolution as part of their debate about who it is, about who should have the right to lead, and so on. And I think that's what's tremendous, because what we're seeing here is not the end of the struggle, I think, but the beginning of a radicalization that embraces millions and millions of people who have had the experience of going on the street, who have had the experience of seeing their loved ones beaten, shot, or even killed, and who understand that this society, whatever its claims to legitimacy, has the interest of a tiny minority at the top. At the forefront, not those of the interests of the massive Iranians. And I think it's I'll close, funnily enough, with a quote from a reporter for the Israeli paper Haaretz, which is a liberal paper in some respects, but not the place where you would expect to go for revolutionary perspectives. But I think that this quote really sums it up. Iran has reached its fork in the road. The direction in which it turns depends not only on the working class. The demonstrators today are those from the middle class, those who are not deprived and who are now working towards attaining freedom and liberty. If they gain the support of the working class, the weaker sectors of society, the poor, the texture of the campaign will take on a completely new dimension. The demand for freedom will be coupled with the demand for bread. In this case, it is difficult to assess whether the regime can withstand such a development. I don't believe it can, and that's why I hope that's what happens.
Does this one work? Is this one on? Okay, great. Fantastic. Okay. So we've got a big room, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions and comments out there. So let me just tell you what I'm gonna do here is, if you want to make a comment or ask a question, if you could just raise your hand. If I can see your name tag and read it, I can use your name. Otherwise, I'm just going to point and talk about maybe an article of clothing that you've got on. And I'm going to take a few comments or questions from folks. I got you. And wait for me to acknowledge that I see you. I got you. Yes, yep. Uh-huh. And then maybe we'll go back to the speakers. Okay? Thank you. So I got you. And it was Mahele?
Malihe.
Okay. Go ahead.
Can I use the mic?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not going to give you a lecture, but I think it's important for women's voices to be heard, too. Just for disclosure, he's my partner. But I'm going to criticize him, too. So just to say, I produce Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I'm your colleague. I think it's important to realize that the specific point that we have to make about Iranian revolution was how the revolution sexualized women's public sphere. And it is very, very disappointing that we speak so much about workers, so much about different types of workers, but we do not bring in the gender perspective in this issue. Now, Barry, the reason women on March 8th went on the streets, and all women, 30,000 women, and again, they did not get any support from the left. They did not.
They were organized by the left.
No. They were not organized. Some of the women who were part of the leftist organization were in it, but there was not a massive support from the left. And the reason that women went on the street on March 8th was because 3 weeks before the after the revolution, Khomeini came and said, starting tomorrow, women cannot go to work naked, and they have to cover themselves. And that led to purging of 2 million women after the revolution. And I think it's important to also note that women have been pivotal in why we are seeing what you see today. Because they have been the only group at the forefront of the struggle for Iranian freedom. The first day on March 8th, they say neither Western nor Eastern, women's rights is human rights. And they simply did not take part in this revolution to go back. You know? And they have been consistently challenging the regime. So it's really important for all of us, for all of you, to have a gendered perspective, the same way that we bring the issue of race, the issue of ethnicity, the issue of work, class into our conversation. That has to be an integral part of how we understand Iran and Iranian politics today.
Thank you. Okay, so next I have in the white collared shirt, you in the back, and then after you will be Sean here in the second row.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment here that I think might be obvious to almost anyone in this room, but it deserves some mentioning, which is what a fantastic blow that the Iranian people have dealt with the racist lie that Muslim people just don't want or can't handle democracy. One way that people talk about why the U.S. should not intervene abroad is because it's always isolationist. It's more or less that, well, they don't want democracy, so why should we be running around the world trying to enforce it at gunpoint? They don't want it anyways. They want a dictator. And I think what we've seen is actually no, and I think it's been refuted pretty thoroughly. I think we, in this country, could learn a thing or two from Iranian people about how to defend democracy. That's something for us to remember for next time. On the question of repression, I mean, I think what we ended with is important. I mean, it's not always known ahead of time how repression will play out. For now, things have been kind of scared off the streets, in my opinion, I think, if you look at it. But obviously, dynamics have been unleashed, which just can't be put back inside the box. I think the splits in the ruling class have taken on a whole new character and a whole new intensity. I think, most importantly, millions of Iranians have been transformed themselves through their own activity. And when you come out on the streets against a regime which has this, you know, a fairly authoritarian and a fairly repressive front, now people who probably never before thought that they would be fighting the police have learned street tactics, and have learned how to knock someone off of a motorcycle and take their weapon and turn it around. And I think they've seen, you know, what the role of the state. I think they've seen what the stakes of the fight really are right now. And then, crucially, I think it's affected millions of people across the Middle East, outside of Iran, who have similar feelings and similar concerns and are hoping that something similar happens in their own country. So I think this has got to be one of the most exciting things that has happened in world history in a number of years. And we have a lot to learn from it for what we're trying to do here.
So after Sean here, there was someone back there with short brown hair and a dark yes, you're after Sean here. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Sort of to follow up on what you said, it seems like there's a lesson to be learned in how people start an uprising, and it seems like there have been several examples where an uprising comes after an election. There's two in Iran now that we've learned about today, and some of us know a little bit about the Orange Revolution. What do we need? What structures do we need in this country so that, like you said, in 2000 or in 2004 with Ohio, if you have questions about that, how do we get this democracy back in a way where we can express it? And how do we learn from this, and how do we bring it to America?
Okay. Thank you. So after you, I saw Baba. You raised your hand over there. Yep, go ahead.
I'm Laura from Los Angeles. I think just in addition to what you said about what's happening in Iran, exposing this lie that, oh, Muslims don't really
young women on the streets fighting the police have totally exposed the, you know, the lie that Muslim women and women in the Middle East are just kind of passively accepting the oppression that is that they're being put under. So I think that, I mean, it's amazing what's happening there right now. But I actually had a question that maybe any of the speakers can address or some of the audience about what is the state of the movement right now, because it seems like the repression really has intensified and is kind of, I don't know if you can say that the government is gaining the upper hand at this point or not, but I don't have as much of a sense of what's been going on in the past couple of weeks since the initial outburst. So if anyone can speak to that, that would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, just one moment. I see a couple more hands, but after you, Baba, I have Joel, and then I saw someone. You had your hand up? Okay, and then in the back. Okay. So I've got the two of you. I'm going to call on the two of you, and then I've got a few more folks in front of the people. Go ahead. Yes. Did you raise your hand, Baba? Isn't that Baba?
Baba can see him right there. Yeah, he raised his
hand. Yeah, you raised your hand. Go ahead.
That's not Baba.
Romanian
revolution.
Who raised
his hand? Where?
Baba raised his hand, too.
Jesus.
The one that started in
1789. You just call out his name.
Okay. It has several characteristics.
I don't see him, sorry. Thank you.
It was one of the biggest, largest mass movements of human history. Which was good. But the Iranian revolution, at the same time, it had some very confusing and absolutely contradictory things in its own nature. And the most contradictory thing in the Iranian revolution was the very fact that it was a revolution and a counter-revolution for the price of one. It was a revolution that masses of what they call today the modern middle class, which I, to me, is a very wrong thing that people they use here. It was a massive number of Iranians who happened to be historically non-religious anyway. Iranians are the most non-religious, non-Islamic people in the whole world. So, the revolution aspect of that was carried out by these people, who were the students, who were the teachers, who were the workers, who were all different strata of the society. But at the same time, there was a second social strata in Iran. And it is that social second strata in Iran that became the force of counter-revolution in the hands of Khomeini. And that was the people of Shantytown. The people who, during the Shah's regime, they were uprooted from the villages. They came to the city. They were not able to be absorbed by the industry in the city, and they were accumulated around as a serpent around the city, and they had huge hostilities to the modern urban life in Iran. Khomeini took advantage of that social strata, and that became the mass support or the mass force of that. What you see today as Basiji is exactly the same group. So what happened on the theater of the Iranian revolution was two things: a massive revolution and a massive counter-revolution. The massive revolution was were the more kind of what they call the more modern people, and the massive counter-revolution were the ones who were organized. They were kind of lumpen proletariat. Some of them were really the lumpen proletariat. Some were the jobless rural people who were organized and who were given some idealistic thing by Khomeini that Khomeini would establish the justice of Ali, which is one of the imams in the Islamic...
Could you please wrap up? I'm sorry.
So basically, what I'm trying to say today is the continuation, the same scenario is starting today. What we are seeing today is that revolution was stifled by the counter-revolution in its own context. And now that we see again the same thing is repeating, the revolution is happening again, and Ahmadinejad, and this is something that even confuses the left, because the left in America, they think that Ahmadinejad is the social base of Ahmadinejad is the road, is the city poor and the rural population, which is not true. First of all, the rural population...
I do need you to wrap up, please.
Yeah, yeah. The rural population was historically never that active in Iranian politics. It's the question of the urban one, and the urban one is this so-called privileged one. During these 20, 30 years, really the state supported and privileged this group in the name of the guard, Basijis, and this social base is really privileged one.
Comrade, no one else will get to speak if I don't move on the list.
So basically, what I'm saying is that this is happening again, and we need to be clear that in Iran there is a mass revolution happening. The masses of Iran that are on the street, they are not the middle class as such, they are the people as such, and the fact that they look modern, there is a modern society, and people there is modern.
Okay, so two things. First, Barry assures me that Babak, you did raise your hand, so you are next. Second, I apologize if I interrupt you, but I'm going to have to go ahead and close the list now because I have more people right now who would like to speak than are going to be able to speak. So, after you, Joel. Yes.
Discussing about Iran and outside of Iran, in West Asia, in the Middle East, people really look up to Iran. They love this revolution process. They all want something like that. Now, U.S. press and TV from the press day of the revolution said the most horrible thing has happened in Iran. A friend of mine here says, for the price of what? Revolution and counter-revolution. By counter-revolution, we mean things like victory of Hitler in 1923 in Germany, victory of Franco in the Spanish Civil War. None of that happened in Iran. None of that. We had nationalist governments set up, and they were Islamic. And some people call them counter-revolutionary because they're Islamic. That is false. We need to get away from that. We need to get away of the factional struggles within the ruling class to see Iran. And what is happening in Iran on the economic front is what is happening in the U.S. We have a worldwide economic crisis instigated by U.S. financial crisis impacting all over the world, and Iranian capitalism cannot stabilize itself because of that. Because of weakness of imperialism, because of weakness of Iranian capitalist class, and people in Iran are demanding a lot of things. So going between the factional disputes of Iranian ruling groups to go and say this faction is holding this economic handle and the other faction is handling this other handle, it's false. It's not true. Economics in Iran has been in the hands of the same ruling group from the first day of the Iranian revolution. That has not changed this. Whoever came to power, they held on to it. Khatami, during his presidency, the one thing he always complained about is I don't run even economics. So that has not changed. So we need to get away from that. Number two, what we need to understand is that Iranian people, for them to go and do something historic, like overthrow the Shah, they overcame the divisions of the ruling group that you see here today in Iran. They united against overthrowing the Shah, against the United States rule over Iran. Today we see the same process opening in Iran. The Iranian unity for the demands that they have in Iran for democracy, for solving the basic questions of industry and agriculture, far outweighs the divisions of the ruling class in Iran. Far outweighs. And it is not true that this faction doesn't have this support, or this faction doesn't have that support. They have massive supports. It is like the situation that you want, like in Germany, people who know about Germany. You need the communist workers and the social democratic workers to unite. You need the Iranians to unite. And what is happening in Iran is new opportunities for independent working class politics. The thing that unfortunately was shut down during the 1980s. That is opening up by the force of events. Now, most importantly, what we can do from here is to demand hands off Iran. It's to demand the right of self-determination of Iran. It's to demand let the Iranian people decide their destiny.
They are very capable of doing that, and you can see it in the streets. What is happening right now in Iran, the streets are out. There is an intense debate what type of repression they want to instigate in the society, and there is a lot of rejection because there is no excuse for that. I mean, people who are supporters of Hamas don't see any reason for extreme repression. People who are supporters of Mousavi don't see that. So there is a lot of basis for unity for moving forward, and the one thing we can do here is stand with all of Iranian people and not get into the division of the ruling groups. Because these divisions, as the USP has made them look so big, are not that big. These will go away in history, and the Iranian people will stand. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so after Joel, in the white V-neck over there, but Joel first, and then you.
Yeah, the theme of this crisis is building a new left for a new era. And that's international. That isn't just here. And what is going on in Iran is the most important left that has developed in this era. The struggle in Iran is the most militant, the most radical, that has come out of the economic crisis. And it is a part of the world economic crisis. I'm glad what the last speaker said, but there are various other aspects, including the level of unemployment, the unemployment among women who graduate from university, which is, I gather, that is driven many of them into the streets and so on. What we're dealing with that may have started about a fraudulent election is a social movement that is massive and that goes well beyond that. This is really the first pre-revolutionary situation of this new period, in which the ruling class cannot rule in the old ways, that is, in its true divide, and the masses of people do not accept rule in the old way. It has opened up all sorts of questions, that is, about the credibility of the state institutions, of the Supreme Leader, of the Guardian Council, of the Basiji, of the Revolutionary Guards, and so on. It has opened up social and economic questions as well. Class questions. Now, that is also faced with an enormous repression. An enormous repression that the movement now has to redevelop, reconnoiter, and figure out how it is going to deal with that. This is a movement that, for the most part, is not very well organized. It is going to have to sort that out. There will be new tactics. There will be new organizations. We don't know how long that process is, but we also have to understand that's what's going to be going on throughout the world. It isn't as if there are well-organized, conscious, revolutionary forces that can provide. They have to be built. They're going to be built out of these processes. Excuse me?
Can you wrap up, please?
Yeah. I just want to make one other. Our success depends upon them. It is also, we have to be supporting them, both in terms of what the last speaker said, in terms of the United States, but also in terms of the development in the left in this country that does understand what side it's on, doesn't notice that it's the masses of people, not an authoritarian government that you support, that looks to the people in struggle, that doesn't say, well, if that government is anti-American, therefore we should support it. That's a struggle that we have to take out ideologically in this country in order to build a new left that can identify itself with and support and be sympathy with the mass struggles that go on every place in the world.
So that I don't cut too much into people's lunch break, and so that our speakers also each get a few minutes to come back on some of the things that have been said, and I know there's a couple questions out there, I'm going to give, I have three last speakers here, and I'm going to give each person 2 minutes each, and then I have two people that had questions. You don't ask your question. I have one person that has a question, and then I will give it back to the speaker. So after you was black cap, white collared shirt. Yep.
What we have to is there are two sides of Iranian culture. It's a Western side and an Eastern side. These two are always together, have been together in Iranian history. And the Western side is looking for the West, Eastern side, Middle East, Islamic culture. And there's a conflict. What we want and what we are fighting for is for their unification. It's not true that they came one day and say, everybody has to wear the hijab. And the Shah's time, they forced everybody not to wear the hijab. It was forced on women. And we, as the people who are socialists, we supported the rights of women to wear whatever they want. Because of their own fights, Iranians forced Iranian women to wear them. It didn't come up one time. It was their own fight that they pushed it on us. And today, they also, during these years, they stopped our socialist paper. They put us in prison. And this all came out of the outcome of the Bourgeois fights. And what we were doing and what we wanted to establish is what we're working with people what we want to support our right, and we want our right as a socialist to be able to republish our paper in Iran again and be able to...
Thank you. So after you, I have... There.
Larry, San Francisco. I wasn't able to go to Iran in 1979, but like many people on the left, I was immersed in the politics of the Iranian Revolution. And the reason for that was there were thousands of Iranian students studying in this country. They were radicalized by the social movements in this country and by the events back home. It was not unusual to go to IS at that time, or ISO meetings later, and you would have supporters, the Mojahideen and the Fedayeen, the two biggest organizations in the revolutionary left, come to our meetings and hotly debate the strategies and tactics of the Iranian Revolution. One of the big mistakes, I mean, on one hand, it sort of represents people like in this room that were attracted to the Mojahideen and the Fedayeen. They were young, they were impatient, they were tired of the failed policies of the Communist Party and the traditional opposition in Iran. But they also made some other mistakes. They believed that the way you activate mass struggle was by armed revolution. You set some kind of example. What that does is that cuts you off from mass movement. If you're engaged in a guerrilla warfare, you can't be organizing the mass movement. Right? That leaves the field open to other forces, the forces of the Iranian clergy. When the Shah was overthrown and those organizations became legal, they started putting out newspapers and started organizing publicly, they made one other key mistake. And I know these comrades are extremely committed, but they make the mistake of, we don't want to take up the hard questions. We don't want to try to win over the supporters of Khomeini on questions. So it's true, on the question of women's rights, the left was absent. I mean, the week of the International Women's Day, there were millions of Iranian women on the streets the entire week protesting against the new law. The left was absent from that. And the reason, because the left had a strategy, they said, you know, what I'm going to do is I don't want to alienate the brother here, so I'm just going to work with him for a while, get him to trust me, and then I'll raise the question of women's liberation. I'll do it some other time. And the same question that came to national minorities. When the Khomeini regime started bombing the Kurdish villages, the left was silent on that question as well. They didn't take up the question aggressively and say, we have to support the right of national minorities. I mean, in Iran, we had the movements on the streets, the women, the minorities, the unemployed, and the left was not able to unite those movements. It was a failure of the left to unite that. And I think the key lesson to draw is the revolutionary left is a movement of the working class, but we have to be the voice of all oppressed people. Right. And as Joel and other people said, the point of this meeting is to build a new left in this country. And I think we can learn a lot from the Iranian working class and the Iranian left both in 1979 and today.
Sorry, if you didn't hear before, I'm not able to take any more hands. We just have you there, and then there's a question in the back, and then I'm going to...
I was on the list there. You pointed to me, you wrote the name down.
I also have about 8 other people in addition to you that also raised their hands and didn't get to speak, so I'm very sorry about that. We can talk more about it afterwards if you'd like. If you, and then the question in the back.
My name is Ricardo. From what I understand, I have a question for the panel. The movement in Iran today is more than just a debate over or a question over what happened in this election. It seems that it's something much bigger than that, as sort of similar from what we saw in 1979. So my question is about Mousavi. Will Mousavi, will he take advantage of this mass movement that is taking place? What is his makeup? From what I understand, he was responsible for the policies of Iran against Iraq, or had an influence in what was taking place in the Iran-Iraqi war. What is his makeup? I know his wife is a professor from the university. Does this guy have any idealism in him, or is he just taking advantage of the situation that is there today at this moment? Or may somebody come from the periphery and take over his position and represent the mass movement that is taking place right now?
Thank you. Yep.
Hi, I'm Kristen. I'm from San Francisco. I've been really shocked and frankly appalled by the positions that sections of the left have taken on what's going on in Iran right now. The fact that they're taking the side of the bullets and the beating sticks that the ruling class is using against the majority of the people in Iran. It's shocking that they can publish that stuff and feel strongly about it. And so my question was, those four theories on imperialism and questions of self-determination, they're not new developments of the left. They've existed for a while. So I was wondering what the left's response to the Iranian Revolution was in 1979. Larry addressed some of that, but I was just wondering if there were equally as horrific responses to some of this stuff going on. And I also wanted to know how important that is now. My hope is that those sort of positions are incapable of gathering anyone around them, and that they fade into irrelevance because they're highly, highly problematic for our project. So I was just wondering.
Okay, thank you. So before I give it back, and I think we'll just go in the same order as we started, Barry, and then Shahram, and then Lee. I have a few announcements. People will just sit tight. Lunch break's perfect time to check out books. Haymarket Bookstore is open at two locations here and also over at the 110 Cap Street site. The entrance is on 16th Street. And they'll be open all day. Dave Zirin's going to be signing books during the lunch break if you're interested in that, and there's also signed copies of Jeff Chang's book available. If you want to become a member of the International Socialist Organization or learn more about what it means to join the ISO, the recruitment desk will be open during lunch near the registration tables, both at Cap Street and also here at the Women's Building. You want to check your schedule to see where the next meeting is located, since it's about a 10-minute walk from here to the other building, and the meetings are not going to be starting more than 5 minutes late. Make sure you have your ID badge with you, and enjoy your lunch break after this. But now we're going to give it back for a couple minutes for each of the speakers to wrap up. Thank you.
Okay. I left out a lot of what I saw of women in the forefront of the revolution in 1979. And that's an important point that Carmen made. I think as we have to keep in mind that the hands of the U.S., they want to go in there. That's not saying, it's the opposite of saying that the U.S. wants to support the demands that we've seen come forward in this last period. They don't. But we have to remember that the U.S. government spent $400 million last year on destabilization in Iran. So there, don't have any illusion that this mightiest imperialist power the world has ever seen is somehow saying, oh, I don't know what to do, because it's not. They're plotting. So therefore, as we join this movement and explain it and defend it, we also have especially living here, we have to say no war against Iran, hands off Iran. I'll say one more thing. John Bolton, heard of him, the guy who was the ambassador to the United Nations, just wrote a piece advocating that Israel bomb Iran now. Another reason we should be against any outside interference, if that happens, then it will give the repressive forces in Iran an opening, and they will do it what they did in the 1980s. There will be thousands killed. So we have to fight against all that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
If it's okay, I'm just going to sit there. Actually, I'm going to give a dissenting opinion here in terms of whether we can call this a mass revolution. Let's be realistic about it. Iranian revolution, at the beginning, the demands were reformist demands. They were trying to take the Iranian monarchy back to implementing what was there in the Iranian constitution and had been abrogated by the Shah. So what the movement is at this point, it's not asking for a change of a regime. At least that's not what we are hearing perhaps here and there. But I'm not denying the fact that people who want to transcend this regime, and there are probably a good portion of the population who wants that. But they're playing it very wisely. So what they're putting out there, because they know otherwise there would be a massive coercion, massive repression, even worse than what you have seen now. So they're playing it very maturely, and that's where I draw a line between the 1979 revolution and now. I think that people out in the streets are very wise. The youth is very mature, more mature than my generation in terms of seeing things. And these are the kind of things that you won't find out by reading the press. So I will argue against any sort of simplification of drawing some simplistic parallels between 1979 and 78 and 79 and now. The other thing I think is important to notice, I don't agree that this, I think this is not just a class war. Let's be very realistic about this. I did not have a chance to go through the other things that I had to say. But you have to look at the social movements in post-revolutionary Iran. The two components, two main groups, are the women and the youth. And I highly recommend this book by an Iranian scholar. I'll pass it around if people want to look at it. It's Don't Get Fooled by the Title. It said Making Islam Democratic, but it's about social movements and the post-Islamist Iran, it's called. And I think I highly recommend people reading about these social movements. Labor is an important point, is an important factor in Iranian history and any change that's going to happen in Iran because of what you mentioned earlier. Street protests are not going to do it. But you have to see the agency of these other forces too. Women, because of the social cultural repression that has been imposed against them, imposition of, I beg to disagree with some of my countrymen and women who spoke earlier. After the revolution, there was Islamic penal code introduced into the society, as opposed to a civil code. There was a Sharia law that was imposed on the society. There were the rights of women were restricted. The right of custody for children, the right of divorce, the right to travel. Women were actually driven out of the workplaces. In fact, something that Ahmadinejad's government, I didn't get a chance to talk about it, he has cut down the number of hours for many female state employees because their notion of role of women is, they need to be doing domestic labor. So, there are many things I can go through. They're changing the textbooks. They're showing the ideal, whatever an ideal Islamic woman would look like. So these are the kind of the things that Iranian women are actually struggling for equal rights. One other thing I want to say, because the state of movement in Iran right now is obviously there's a moment of reflection because of the coercion. the exploring other alternatives such as work stoppage, other forms of collective action like strikes and other things that could be taken, boycotts of goods and things like that. But generally speaking, we should not build our expectations very high. You have to understand this is going to be a gradual process. 78-79 was, and I'll finish with this, that was one of the problems in the 78-79 revolution, because there was not enough time. These are what we call insurrection type of movements, as opposed to social movements. When you don't have time to have a discourse or discussion on what should the course of action be, what should the goals be, what should the leadership look like. And right now, I think this movement is going to be more mature. They're going to be actually taking the time in terms of reflecting on things. Thank you very much.
Yeah, on the question of the U.S., the U.S. is intervening in a big way already, as we know. Sanctions have been on for years. The U.S. is intervening in struggles of national minorities. If you're in the Kurdish Workers' Party in Turkey, the U.S. supplies guns to have you crushed, but if you're fighting in Iran, you get the money and guns from the CIA. The same for the Baluchis, who are repressed, as seen as Taliban sympathizers in Pakistan, but across the border in Iran, they're given money and guns. Jandala is a Sunni extremist group. Would it be repressed as a Taliban-like formation inside Pakistan? But it's given aid to carry out bombings of civilians on the other side. So that's all that's playing out. And, of course, the nuclear sanctions are the height of imperialist hypocrisy. India has a deal for basically unregulated expansion of nuclear power with the U.S. and Western nuclear industries, where Iran, for pursuing a nuclear policy which is legal under international treaties, faces sanctions. And it's important to realize that the neocons like Ahmadinejad in power. Daniel Pipes, the reactionary so-called Middle East expert, said as much in the weeks before the election. It's better to have someone like that who we can galvanize support against as well. So I think that's one thing. So hands off Iran, self-determination for Iran, that has to be a starting point for anyone in this country. But at the same time, we have to then figure out how do we engage in this left and understand it. And I think Malihe was right to talk about the importance of women. There's an incredible statistic. There's a defeminization of the workforce. Women were driven out of the workforce in the post-revolutionary era. But in recent years, the illiteracy rate among women, or literacy rate, went from 20% to 65% over the course of the revolution. Today, women are 63% of entrants into the universities, and they actually are the majority of all the faculties at the University of Tehran, the leading university. But women are only 12% of the labor force. So there's a gap. Unemployed, highly educated people who are forced to deal with this. And they've been organizing. When one of Ahmadinejad's legal gamuts was to try to pass a law of making polygamy easier, making it easier to have multiple wives, there was women's protest shut it down. They forced a retreat in the parliament. So all that is part of that. And you can see, in terms of YouTube videos, you can see the extent to which women, some of them young student types, some of them clad in chadors and so on, are in the forefront of fighting the cops. And I've read different accounts of women berating men for running away and going into the forefront themselves. And I think that those social forces among the youth and the women then play in with the workers. They're not separate processes. They're all part of. They're all responding to the same thing of a country, despite the increase in oil wealth, not able to meet the basic demands of the population. And I think it is important to understand that this is a counter-revolutionary regime. It stole power. It hijacked a workers' revolution. It didn't go to the extent of a Hitler or Franco, but it banned, smashed all independent working class organizations. It smashed the left, jailed and slaughtered them. I don't, people went through that, don't need to hear that from me. And I think that qualifies as a counter-revolution.